Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ah, yes, the dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy. Shushas and soft coughs and coats draped over red velvet theater seats. Curtains up on the Nutcracker Ballet and the Holidays. There's a long pedigree to Clara, the Mouse King, the Cavalier Prince, and the Snow Queen, from a German romantic novella to Russia's Tchaikovsky to the ballet that's being performed all over America this season. This hour on Point, the tale of the Nutcracker from soup to nuts. You can join the conversation, what keeps it coming on? What's your take on the Nutcracker? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll be joined by ballet star Damian Wetzel. But first, joining me from Irvine, California, is Jennifer Fisher. She's author of Nutcracker Nation, How an Old World Ballet Became a Christmas Tradition in the New World. She is herself a former dancer and actor and now professor of dance at University of California, Irvine. Now, Jennifer Fisher, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Just great to have you. And Roland John Wiley joins us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. He's a professor of musicology at the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance, and author of a major biography of the composer of the Nutcracker Ballet titled simply Tchaikovsky. John Wiley, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hello, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
John, take us all the way back, if you would, for a moment here. Where did the Nutcracker come in the life of this great Russian romantic composer, Tchaikovsky?
It came in a series of commissions that he received from the Imperial Theaters, which was getting to be something of a regular practice in the later years of his life. It was modeled on a French pattern of having an opera followed by a balletic afterpiece, which had been the practice in Paris, and it actually had spread to London in the later 18th century. And so this was something that he agreed to do. We're not quite sure about some of the organizing thoughts that went into the collaboration, but it was part of a sequence, and they wanted something. They, the Imperial Theaters, wanted something new from him every season.
It was his third and final ballet after Swan Lake and Sleeping Beauty. This one didn't come until 1891-92. I mean, the history comes down to it that he himself was not entirely satisfied with his last ballet, John.
Well, he was unhappy in the course of collaboration, and we must remember that composers don't tell us all of the things that we would like to know 100 years later as we look back on these things. When he was writing the second act, having to do with the Land of Sweets, he wrote to the director of Imperial Theaters, and for reasons he didn't specify, he simply said, "I can't do this. These images are not working. And we need to either let me out of this or to postpone." And this was the first signal that something was not quite the matter. This was happening, incidentally, at the convergence of two events in his life. One was his trip to America, which was just about to happen when he wrote this letter within a month or so. And the other was the loss of a family member. He was extremely close to his siblings, especially his sister and his two younger brothers. And the sister, on whose estate he had spent months of time over the years, had just died. And so this was one factor, although he never did say, "I can't write this ballet because I'm in grief or I'm in mourning over my sister." So we're not quite sure, but there were some problems.
He came to America. We have to remember he was such a celebrated musician, Russian musician in those days, summoned to America to open, I think, Carnegie Hall, if I'm not right. Wrong,
that is
John.
Correct. That is correct.
Jennifer, we want to think about that, the first performances of this, but take us even further back for a moment to the story on which this is based. E.T.A. Hoffmann, the German romantic, a century earlier, who was he? Where did this story come from in his creative satchel?
Well, I think one of the things that you never find out when you're a dancer growing up in the ballet is why there is a nutcracker. And when I set out to do research, I found out, because the nutcracker doesn't matter to a young dancer, not the wooden item itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, your pointe shoes matter, your technique matters.
Right.
So I found out that nutcracker carving in the eastern mountain region of Germany was something that working people did, miners perhaps, and it was to carve figures where they could poke fun at figures of authority. In other words, mm-hmm. if you had a mayor of your town, someone who was oppressive in government, someone you didn't like, then you carved this and made them crack your nuts.
That's funny. So, and you can lever it so their mouth is going yak, 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 yak. We can just imagine it as kind of a send-up.
Well, there is a series of American presidents made as nutcrackers, yes. So we can certainly – I never understood when I was younger. Nutcracker was all ballet, so why were they making a Lincoln, a Washington nutcracker? This made no sense. But it was supposed to be this figure that poked fun at authority. So the nutcracker was the centerpiece. E.T.A. Hoffman wrote this novella, which also is of little interest to ballet people because – they are not dancing that scenario. There was a translation by Alexandre Dumas-Père, mm-hmm. and it was read widely in St. Petersburg in French. People say it was quite different and lighthearted, but I found the two stories very similar to me at this point in history. And then it was adapted. This was quite popular as a Christmas story, but when it was adapted for the stage, there was far too much sort of cursing into ugliness and bits of fat in the story, things that wouldn't look good on the imperial stage of Russia. So it was very simplified, and many choreographers today like to go back, such as Mark Morris, for one, like to go back to that original tale. They're always trying to make the Nutcracker, quote, more serious, more dark. And in my exploration of its biggest popularity in the United States, darkness and seriousness is not a direct correlation. I think it's very serious, partly due to this extraordinary score, but it certainly, going back to Hoffman, has never been my favorite way of approaching.
Let's listen to a little bit. Of course, it is Christmas here. There's the tree. Clara is given the wooden nutcracker, as Jennifer described by her godfather, Herr Drosselmeyer. This is the Herr Drosselmeyer's gifts from the New York City Ballet Orchestra. Drosselmeyer's gifts, and it's funny, Jennifer, John, you can hear underneath the sweetness, some of that boom, boom of the composer who wrote the 1812 Overture even there. But what was the reception, Jennifer, when it first came before, I guess, what, the Imperial Court in Russia, 1892? How did they find it?
Well, I think that question should go to Professor Wiley because I have built on his original research.
Oh, well, let's go to the source then.
To compiling all of those critics. I can see the pages of his book before me because it was wonderful to have all that material in the same place.
Professor Wiley, tell us then from Ann Arbor, how did it play?
It was mixed. We have various factions coming to the first performance, which was in the Mariinsky Theater. Here again, I have to offer a caution. These people were coming, as all first performance critics are, to something that they had never seen before, and they are giving us fast reactions. And so we don't necessarily have to take what they did as being writ in stone. There was a faction of balletomans. And they were very philistine and straight-laced, and the work just wasn't happy for them at all, for the reasons that you might expect. It had an imbalance of dance and mime. The ballerina didn't show up until the second act. She didn't dance until practically the last number. Meanwhile, we're watching children and ensemble dancing, and this wasn't the kind of thing that these people liked. They also got fretful about the story, which in the original scenario left Clara and the Nutcracker in the Land of Sweets. They never came home, and we are left with wondering what Clara's parents thought when she wasn't there the next day,
right.
This kind of thing. So there was an obvious flaw there. And in a way, they had a point. Musicians came around much more warmly to it after a couple of performances and declared it the best ballet music that he had ever written. So it divides principally along lines of ballet critic or music critic. The ballet critics didn't like it very much, and the music critics did.
And then, Jennifer, as you write, and we've just got a minute before the break here, but it goes into a kind of long hibernation until it makes the transatlantic jump to America's shores where it goes wild.
Well, I think it existed, but it was never a favorite of the Russians. So it's in these productions. It would be revived. It was often done at the Summer Palace, or it was piecemeal. They would take the music, which is so stunning.
The Summer Palace? Not at Christmas time?
Or not at Christmas time. It was not pegged as a ritual. And this is where my work says this has become a ritual, which a few critics have said before me, looking at it as an annual, what I call the annual Nutcracker. Mm-hmm. No, indeed, it wasn't. In fact, in Los Angeles here, because we didn't have a company, the New York City Ballet would come out in the summertime, out of season completely.
And get a nice little chill. We're going to come back and hear much more, and we're going to hear from the great dancer Damian Wetzel. We're talking about the Nutcracker from before Tchaikovsky to the ballet, its music, and its crowds today. Jennifer Fisher is with us, author of Nutcracker Nation, and Professor Roland John Wiley, author of Tchaikovsky from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is here. You can join us. Is the Nutcracker part of your holiday, your tradition? 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Nutcracker from before Tchaikovsky to the ballet, its music, and its crowds today with Jennifer Fisher. She's author of Nutcracker Nation, How an Old World Ballet Became a Christmas Tradition in the New World. Joins us from Irvine, California. And from Ann Arbor, Michigan, John Wiley, professor of musicology at the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance, author of the big biography Tchaikovsky, just out last year. You can join the conversation this hour. Does three bars of the music take you there? Do you still feel Tchaikovsky and the Russian origins of the ballet? Or does it feel somehow thoroughly American now to you? What's the pull? The magic. Do you like it straight up and traditional or a little funky? And why is this the ballet of all ballets that pulls in the crowds and the money? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're going to hear in just a moment from the great dancer Damian Wetzel. Lots of listener comments here. Kara writes, she's got 12 Waltz of the Flowers costumes hanging in her dining room right now, waiting to be steamed for her 14-year-old daughter's local ballet school production. Three shows sold out in a week. Ashley May writes, it was the first ballet I saw at age 10. Our gifted program sent us to see it at the Oklahoma City Civic Hall. It was amazing. She's loved it ever since. Lewis says, I prefer the urban Nutcracker that Anthony Williams created with music from Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn. It swings, and we will hear a little bit of that later. And Lucy writes, nice story, beautiful ballet, but so trite, so perverse in ads. We'll look at all of that. Let's get one call right here. Paul in Salt Lake City. Thanks very much for calling, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you see? What do you know?
Well, I'm a former dancer. I used to dance with Ballet West and I performed in the first full-length Nutcracker that was ever brought over to America, Willem Christensen's version of it.
Wow.
But I also danced over in Europe, and when I danced in Germany, the company I danced with there, the ballet company, we didn't perform Nutcracker in December or in the Christmas season. That seems to be a very American thing. I was wondering what the what your guests there think about that whole thing, about it being an American tradition.
Well, I guess to look at that, we'll have Damien Wetzel in just a second and get him on this. But just to go to it, I mean, it was Jennifer, described the leap. You write about it from old world to new. Here we go to Balanchine and the whole American sort of presentation of the Nutcracker.
Well, the caller is right. Willem Christensen first did the Nutcracker in San Francisco because the War Memorial Auditorium happened to be empty at Christmas time. Somebody points out this is a Christmas-themed ballet. Now, ballet is ballet. Tchaikovsky ballet, you can play any time of year. Mm-hmm. But yes, it has a Christmas scene in it. And he doesn't do it the next year, but then the next year starts the annual tradition. It just worked. He got advice from Russians who had done the ballet, but Balanchine's advice was do your own version, which he did. And then that's 1944, the first one in San Francisco, first full length, I should say, because the Ballet Russe had been touring from Europe with a one-act version. Walt Disney had done Fantasia and taken the music and animated. I think I'm the first dance analysis of Fantasia, of cartoon characters as ballet aesthetics, but I think it really brought the ballet into a lot of Americans' lives. Then in 1954, the tradition Damien Wetzel was schooled in is Balanchine, the great Russian immigrant who really made ballet American. And he does his own version, but he's the real thing. He comes from Russia. No one suspected he didn't take that much. Ivanov, the original choreographer, about whom Professor Wiley has written a wonderful book. So Balanchine does his own version, and he's in New York City, the center of the dance universe, and it influenced the nation a lot. Dancers would retire, companies would look to New York for a model, they would do their own version, they would do a version that was taken from the Royal Ballet, which Professor Wiley knows a lot about, because the ballet was notated about 1909, I think, then eventually brought to London. And a lot of that choreography, which explains why the Sugar Plum Fairies dance looks very similar in many, many, many productions, a lot of people take what we think we know about the original choreography. So there are two traditions, and from that, an absolute explosion. Balanchine, what we know of Ivanov, and then everybody puts their two cents worth in, which is why it was an American immigrant. Everybody made it their own in different ways, and it was very ripe for adaptation.
Let's take it straight to a great dancer. Damien Wetzel joins us from Roxbury, Connecticut. He's former principal dancer with the New York City Ballet, now a lecturer at Harvard Law School. He's also currently co-hosting with actress Sarah Jessica Parker a special series running all this month on Ovation TV called Battle of the Nutcrackers Dance Off. That sounds thoroughly contemporary. Damien Wetzel, thank you so much for being with us. Great to have you here.
Good to be with you, Tom, and hello to everyone else.
Let's just go straight to the dancing first. I mean, you've been there, you've danced so many ballets. You've danced this one. What's it like to be in the heart of this one? Do you feel like you're dancing in a throwaway ritual that brings in the bucks? Or as a dancer, is this as, I don't know, challenging, satisfying as anything else?
I definitely go with the latter interpretation. For me, I've often heard dancers say, oh, here we go again. You know, it's this annual thing like you kind of implied. But, you know, the truth is it's an introduction to dance for so many people in America, certainly, and I'm no different. I actually had studied ballet since I was very young. I started at 4. But the first time I was ever on stage was, of course, in the Nutcracker at 7 in Boston. And, you know, it's magic in that way that you just don't get over, at least I don't. And you know, every time I hear that overture start, I find it truly transporting, and I think, you know, sometimes things last for a reason because they're really good. It's the Tchaikovsky music certainly, but it's also that sense of holiday ritual. But as Paul noted, you know, I mean, even Balanchine's production didn't premiere at Christmas; it was in February, and subsequently it became that Christmas ritual, that holiday, that thing that just drives so many ballet companies that. I know Jennifer can speak to the power of, you know, the economic power of it, but I know Balanchine spoke and wrote of, you know, oh, well, every child has parents and cousins and grandpas and grandmothers and, you know, it fills the house. And there was a great feeling like, let's do a full length that works type thing. And I think that really kind of is all wrapped up into it.
Damien, you've danced a lot of it, and you speak to the children who get introduced to the stage, the big stage, with the Nutcracker. We've got callers just on that point. Jennifer in Rineyville, Kentucky. Jennifer, you're on with Damien Wetzel, John Wiley, Jennifer Fisher. Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
What's your story?
My name is Jennifer Allen. My little boy's name is Alexander. I started taking him to see the Nutcracker when he was one. And when he was 6 years old, he told me he was tired of watching it. He wanted to do it.
That's a story.
Yes, so he started taking tap and ballet lessons. So this will make his second year in the production. And this year, and like last year, he has three parts. He is a party boy, a Snow Queen's footman, and a gingerbread boy. And in our town, this makes the 34th year of the production.
Wow. And is Alexander enjoying it, Jennifer, Mother Jennifer?
Oh, he absolutely loves it, and he intends to continue on as long as he can do it.
Wow, that's pretty fantastic. Good luck to Alexander. Congratulations to him for being in the middle of it. Damien, what roles have you danced in this ballet over the years?
Well, I started in the party scene as a party boy going to the Christmas celebration, and then I graduated to Fritz, which is the brother of the young heroine, Clara or Marie, depending on the version. Mm-hmm. And from there, I grew up in the ballet, essentially. I did soldiers, and then I did soldier dolls, and then once I became a professional dancer, I graduated up to Chinese dances and candy cane, and then ultimately to the Cavalier. And I danced in productions starting as a kid in Boston, but then in Los Angeles and the Los Angeles Ballet in the early 1980s, and then New York City Ballet. But then, you know, as a part of this grand tradition, I danced it in all around America and in other places around the world as well, because it is such a favorite. It's the kind of thing you get calls to come and do as a guest artist. And I did the movie version of the Balanchine production with Macaulay Culkin as the prince some years ago, and that led to a whole kind of, you know, Nutcracker mania at that point a little bit. So a lot of different roles in a lot of different versions, but certainly the one that, you know, I'm most closely, a part of my life has been the Balanchine version.
Let's take it right up to that Cavalier role. Here's the music, Sugar Plum Fairy and the Cavalier with their pas de deux from Tchaikovsky's The Nutcracker, New York City Ballet Orchestra here, 1993 performance. Down it goes there, the Sugar Plum Fairy and the Cavalier Pas Deux, and then this kind of weeping that comes in. John Wiley, you've written about this. What's going on there? That's not, candy canes and sugar sweets.
Well, what's going on there? It's another question that we wish Tchaikovsky could have answered for us, because since he didn't, we're required to interpret. We now know that Tchaikovsky encoded certain ideas into certain of his pieces. And the music, right at this point where it's about to go down that octave again, involves a rhythm that he used in several of what might be called fateful pieces, including Yevgeny Onegin, where both Lenski the poet and Tatiana use this rhythm. We have no way of proving this, but it happens to correspond to the verbal rhythm of the Orthodox Panahida, which is a funeral service. And this brings me back to the question of his sister's death, his steamship passing on his way to New York, where he wrote about becoming reconciled with the land of sweets, and he mentioned it as being thoughts about his sister. And so this is the introduction. This is the entree to the pas de deux. Notice when the Sugar Plum Fairy comes out, she gets the celesta, which is an instrument which creates a certain sense of vividness, a certain sense of glow, you might say. But before this, he gives us nothing really in the melody except this descending octave, which he gives us several times. That's basically the substance of the entree. And it has this rhythm. And if you're, you know, following Tchaikovsky's wavelength, so to speak, or you think you're following it, it does get back to Deathly Questions, and it does get back to memorialization of a family member whom he loved.
Damien Wetzel, you've danced it. You felt that I don't know what you felt in your bones when you danced that. Does that interpretation sort of line up with what you sort of felt in the musculature as you danced this?
Well, I can't say that the memorialization part, no, not exactly. Thankfully, in some ways, because it also had a feeling of celebration probably more. But I think that, you know, from a dancer point of view, there's the feeling of progression that goes through that adagio. Some of it is simply the fact that it continues, that continuing descending scale, and some of it is the loudness of it as it grows and grows, and you feel like you're being pushed forward and forward and forward. And Balanchine's choreography certainly reflected that greatly in the progression. It never has a kind of stultifying moment where you're stuck. It's just you're always being pushed forward and forward and forward.
And Jennifer, you found even some sexual politics there in the pas de deux.
I have often found sexual politics, but I was so feeling so rhapsodic as I listened to that music, which is very hard to speak over. But hearing Professor Wiley speak the musicology of explaining why I felt as a young dancer when I heard this, I knew nothing about Tchaikovsky, but I would come. It would bring me to tears all the time, and I would wonder. This is a children's ballet. I would wonder, and his explanation, which is logical and of course just speculation, but not to me. His explanation says exactly. I don't know about Tchaikovsky's sister, but Tchaikovsky put a heart into the ballet, all through the ballet. I say he put a backbone in the ballet, but the heart is right there. And I think it's Professor Wiley who says that this chord, descending chords scale, is like the insistence of a prayer-like insistence. And it's part of the spirituality of the ballet, not just that Balanchine talked about the theater as a church and how a kind of religious dedication pervades the life of ballet and dancers and even balletomanes who go in and worship at the theater in a way. That's why the Nutcracker is such a great secular ritual, drawing a very diverse country together to celebrate a time of year. And hearing Tchaikovsky take us to these heights, seeing the dancers, literally, I was thinking of Damien has to lift somebody. He can't get completely lost in the music. But it drives him on. It drives us all on to have this experience at a very important time of year, whether or not you're celebrating the religious holiday.
Damien, do you feel that ritual quality backstage as you're in the wings or on the stage with the Nutcracker?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. I just wanted to follow up on the previous point about that statement, if you will. It's like it makes that statement in the adagio, and then it restates it again with increasing volume, but also in small variations that, you know, you do get lost in it to some extent, even lifting, frankly.
But good to know.
The ritual, you know, for me, it's just a completely wonderful, transporting thing every year. The first time, as I said, when that overture starts, or that wonderful music as the transition from the battle into the snow scene. And, you know, Marie has triumphed. You know, she's thrown her shoe, and then she's fainted. And in Balanchine's version, the bed just transports around the stage. And it's just, oh, wow, what a dream.
Damien Wetzel, it is so great to have you with us. We've got to take a short break right here. Hold the thought, Jennifer. We'll come right back. Lots of callers waiting to come in here as well. Damien Wetzel, former principal dancer with the New York City Ballet. Last year, President Obama appointed him to the President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities. Joins us from Roxbury, Connecticut. Roland John Wiley is with us, author of Tchaikovsky, joining us from Ann Arbor. And Jennifer Fisher in Irvine, California, author of Nutcracker Nation, How an Old World Ballet Became a Christmas Tradition in the New World. We'll go out of this segment with Duke Ellington's Coffee Arabia, his interpretation of that dance from 1960. How great. Listeners, you can join us, 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Nutcracker from way before Tchaikovsky to its life in the United States and around the world today. You can join us. Have you danced it when you were 10, when you were 25? Has the Nutcracker become a cliche? Does it matter? And what's the dream image, the feeling this music brings to mind for you? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. John Wiley is with us, author of Tchaikovsky, Jennifer Fisher of Nutcracker Nation, and Damian Wetzel is with us, former principal dancer with the New York City Ballet. He's currently hosting with actress Sarah Jessica Parker a special series running all this month on Ovation TV called Battle of the Nutcrackers Dance Off, and we will hear about that. 800-423-8255. Let's hear from our listeners. Lucia in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Lucia, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just took my daughter, my daughter went to the Nutcracker for the second time. She's four, last year and this year. Mm-hmm. And I think the question you asked at the very beginning, what makes the Nutcracker endure? The appeal to children and the presence of children on stage is a huge, huge thing. But I think that the opening scene with Drosselmeyer and giving the gift of the Nutcracker is second only to Santa Claus in the North Pole for that desire for material things and the magic of gift-giving. It's something that's endured with me ever since I was a little girl. And I definitely think that sense of magic that just unfolds starting with that image one of the things that keeps people coming back.
Lucia, you put it just right, and good luck to your daughter there. It starts with that material Nutcracker and goes quickly to magic, no question. One more, Nashville, Tennessee. Thanks, Lucia. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm actually the artistic director of a professional company in Nashville, Tennessee.
You can name it for us, Paul. Which company?
Nashville Ballet.
Wonderful. Thank you.
And I agree with Lucia. It's, you know, we do... The ballet world does Nutcracker. This is probably my 32nd year of doing it. And whenever I feel tired or weary of the Nutcracker and of the, all that goes into it in the holiday times, I always go and hang out with the children of the cast and or go out into the audience because they have the essence, you know, and it kind of gives me, I call it my Nutcracker fix and my child fix because they have the energy and they have that... That innocence that we're all looking for, I think, around this time. And you know, the music is the key, and it's given us this great hook to kind of create our own traditions in that uniquely American way, you know, where we can create ourselves and we can kind of do whatever we want.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people responding today. Paul, thank you so much for that, and good luck with your work there in Nashville. Some great comments. Here's one from Brian in New London, Connecticut. Says, the Nutcracker is about how thoughtful gifts can help children discover the unique gifts within themselves and teach them how to share them with the world. And then a story from Brenda. I love this. Both our daughters, she writes, performed in the Nutcracker years ago when we were stationed in Corpus Christi, Texas. Our youngest was a mouse and was scheduled to appear in one of the mice scene. She confessed to us last year, 14 years later, that she actually ran out and danced for each mouse scene. At the age of six, she'd already figured out that one more mouse on the stage probably wouldn't be noticed. Brenda, thank you for that. I mean, Damian, you must have seen the joy. You felt it yourself of children coming into the presence of this kind of magic.
Absolutely. I mean, I felt it myself doing it, and now I feel it watching them. Or, you know, it's funny to hear about Corpus Christi. I mean, I remember I guested and did Nutcracker in Corpus Christi myself, I mean, I don't know, 20 years ago or so. And to see the children from all these different productions that I would visit was always so heartwarming, and the care that would go into it and the involvement of parents
specifically in this ritual is really something to think about as well, because it's a very galvanizing force. Putting on a production like the Nutcracker, as anybody who's ever been involved with it from the level of, you know, whether it's at Lincoln Center or in a small town, everybody has to get involved to make this happen. And that really speaks to the power of the ballet itself, the power of the arts, and the power of, you know, as, you know, Mickey and Judy putting on a show, getting together and making that happen. And then for a child to get to participate in that way in something that, like this, and also something truly, as people keep going back to, something magical. You know, it's not trite. It's magic, actually. And the gift giving is part of it. And that goes down through time. Balanchine spoke of that. You know, it's very serious business, Christmas in St. Petersburg, in Imperial St. Petersburg. But still, the children, it was about the food and the things hanging on the tree and the magic of what might happen.
Here's the Tea China Movement. Again, New York City Ballet Orchestra. John Wiley, speak to us as a professor of musicology. I mean, what is it that Tchaikovsky does? Music has all kinds of ways of getting under our skin, and it can have all kinds of reactions, but this sense of magic, what is it in the instrumentation, in the score, that just produces that again and again?
Part of it is the orchestration. The man was a master at creating sounds. Part of it is the imagination for pictorializing. This man could pictorialize practically anything. I mean, the mice in Sleeping Beauty, flying witches through the moonlight, you name it. He could to say nothing of the more famous passages like Romeo and Juliet in 1812. Mm-hmm. So that would be the primary substantive matters. But I think also his heart was in these things. He could not do that unless he partook a little bit of the childlike nature of this, or the patriotic nature of 1812, or the love nature of Romeo and Juliet. So it's an extremely gifted imagination, along with a willingness to let go and employ that imagination to create extraordinary sounds that stay in the memory.
Jennifer, it's funny, you know, a part of me has always resisted the ballet of this and just gone with the score, the sort of, I don't know, Little House on the Prairie where I grew up. There was no ballet. I never saw the dance. There was not even a television to watch it on, but there was the old big LP album, and it came out every year in December. And as a child, I was so transported by the music alone that it was almost like, you know, having read the book, you don't want to see the movie. You've got your own drama in mind.
Well, I think you can search out so many different ways to watch it danced to. Those of us in the dance world think of music as something that hasn't been choreographed to half the time, because we want to be moving. So the Nutcracker has this wonderful combination, I think. It includes a lot of what Damien has put so beautifully, the communities, the magic, but also individuals who are striving to be professionals. There's a communal feeling, but the individual dancers are achieving. It's very fashionable to do what I call nut bashing. And I'm so glad to hear artistic directors phoning in. A dancer in an elite company like Balanchine's, of course, is where you don't get any nut bashing, because Mr. Balanchine made this. In the rest of the world, the ballet world often really underrates this power that Tchaikovsky gives, but also conceptually the way that the ballet was planned and the way it brings people together in communities while it's professional, a rite of passage, a secular ritual, ripe for adaptation. All of these things make it something that lives every year.
Let's get a call from Tracy, Norwell, Massachusetts. Hi, Tracy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had to call because I four generations of my family have been involved in the Boston Ballet version of Nutcracker.
Wow.
I danced it as a child for 6 years. I started when I was nine. My mother and aunt were soloists. My aunt was the Dewdrop Fairy.
Oh, wow.
My grandmother, back before it was Boston Ballet, all the parents had to make the costumes.
Wow.
Because there was no money.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandmother, who was an excellent seamstress, ended up making most of the original costumes for the Boston Ballet version.
How terrific.
Of the Nutcracker.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
And now my niece is playing Clara this year in a local version.
Well, congratulations. Grandma's hands making the costumes and the fourth generation heading on to the Nutcracker. That is just great. Tracy, thank you very much for that call. We've got a little bit here from Damien Wetzel's Ovation TV Dance-Off Battle of the Nutcrackers, talking here with the famous choreographer Mark Morris about why he created his own version of the ballet called The Hard Nut, premiered in 1991.
The music of the Nutcracker was so overly familiar to me and to all my dancer friends that I wanted to go back to it and find out why it was so beautiful and so moving, and why it drives you crazy. If you hear it so much, it gets stuck in your head. So I wanted to purge myself of that connotation of the music and go back. And that's why I went back to the E.T.A. Hoffman story and why I really included every note of music and tried to make from the ground up a fresh production of this piece.
Damien Wetzel, there's Mark Morris talking in your Ovation TV special. Could you sympathize with wanting to go back and sort of rebuild it from the ground up as a dancer, as a choreographer?
I think, you know, people have been talking a little bit about the music, and Mark certainly talks about that right there, as being this binding element. And that's, that's what the Battle of Nutcracker is all about, actually. It's about showing how so many people, so many places, all are, you know, inspired by this music. And whether it's a matter of that it's so familiar that they need to readdress it, or that it's just something they've always, you know, felt in their heart that they needed to say their own way. But it's to show all these different versions from around the world. And, you know, it speaks to the power of the thing itself. It's the story and it's the music together that just, Jennifer talked about the nut bashing. I think it's almost like a fashionable thing to say.
Mm.
But you can also, the postscript is that, but of course we're going to go to see it.
You're having a downright dance-off. You've got the Bolshoi and the Berlin State Opera and the Ballet of Monte Carlo and others on Ovation TV. What do you see in the distinctions?
It's an interesting group that Ovation picked this year. They're all from across the pond. So, you know, in terms of, like, the Nutcracker colonizing America, we don't have to actually address that, really. But you see wildly different interpretations. I mean, the one I think they're showing tonight, Friday night, is Maurice Béjart's production, and he passed away a few years ago, but not before making this production, which really addresses his childhood. It's through the prism of his 7-year-old holidays, and I'll leave it at that. But you can imagine that's nothing to do with, you know, what we would traditionally expect. And from that, you can go to the Bolshoi, which is much more what one would expect. And there's different ways of doing it in terms of how many children are involved. You know, one of the fashionable things that changed at a certain point was that they wanted more dancing in the first act. So the Clara or Marie character would be an adult who looked a little childlike, and strange things like that, you know, vary from what we might all say, oh, no, that's not my Nutcracker. But it gives a chance, this type of thing on Ovation, for everybody to kind of see different things and then vote on it in a very much 21st century way. So spanning the centuries.
Let's go to Vanessa in Somerville, Massachusetts. Vanessa, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good. What do you know?
I am actually the artistic director for a local production called The Slutcracker.
Oh, okay, what is that?
Well, it's pretty funny you bring me in during all the talk of children. some might call it nut bashing, but what I've done is I've also rebuilt the Nutcracker from the ground up.
I think I've seen some talk of this, kind of a burlesque version of the Nutcracker.
Yes. We actually call it a burlesque because it is, in true definition, a burlesque of the ballet, The Nutcracker. So it's a scene-by-scene retelling of The Nutcracker. And I took what I thought were sort of the seedy undertones of The Nutcracker and brought them right to the front of the stage.
And so
I think that's fabulous. Really, The Nutcracker is such a tradition that, of course, people are going to do send-ups of it. And people expect me as a Nutcracker scholar, are you offended by this? And I'm absolutely not. It just shows how strong the tradition is and that everyone needs a version, even if it's kids not allowed in under 16 or something, as long as you say what you're doing. I think it's so much fun to have these pastiches and burlesques of the Nutcracker that's very funny. There's a hip-hop version that's being built out here, and there's been Nutcracker on Ice and Tap Dancing Nutcracker, and it's great. The more, the merrier.
Vanessa, thanks for your call. You know, we're hearing so much right now, of course, about another Tchaikovsky-based work, Swan Lake, and the movie Black Swan is out there, promoted again and again as a psychosexual thriller. What about the sexual politics or even seedy undertones, as Vanessa has it, Jennifer, in The Nutcracker?
Well, I don't like versions when it gets very psychological. Nureyev did one where Clara becomes this on the cusp of womanhood and it gets very psychologized. I think basically the sexual politics of it for me is that in the ballet world, women predominate, but they don't, a young girl never gets the leading role in a ballet. And the Russians didn't like this. They made her a ballerina. Whereas in America, we think the children are the future and children started to predominate. And boys were able to get into the ballet world, what I call under the wire. They say, you know, dad doesn't want me to take ballet, but I'm going to be a soldier. That's okay. I'm going to be a boy at a party. That's okay. I'm going to find girls at the party when you're a little early, older. So they get in. This prejudice against men in dancing doesn't pertain so much to the Nutcracker. And the idea of having the Sugar Plum Fairy, who I call the sole monarch of a burgeoning candy nation, and the Cavalier has, poor thing, he does mostly lifting and gets the shortest male variation in the repertoire. So women, especially in all of these wonderful regional productions, which is practically anything outside of urban centers, women run the show. They get to choreograph more than they do in the professional world. They are artistic directors. They are volunteers. It becomes a woman's world. And I think that, to me, helped me come of age in a world in the 50s and early 60s when women weren't supposed to achieve. I was literally set in motion, and lots of little girls and boys are nowadays.
Oh, that's a beautiful thing. We can't even get to all of our calls. Laura's calling in to say that she went into labor during the Nutcracker and would not leave. Speaking of girl, woman power in the middle of this. What a pleasure to be in the midst of all this in this holiday season with such three great interpreters of the great music and the great ballet. We're out of time right there, but it's just been really a joy, and I want to thank each of you for being with us. Damian Wetzel, former principal dancer with the New York City Ballet, co-hosting Battle of the Nutcrackers Dance-Off on Ovation TV with Sarah Jessica Parker. Damian, thank you for being with us today.
Good to be with you.
John Wiley in Ann Arbor, author of Tchaikovsky, thank you so much, John.
It's been my pleasure.
And Jennifer Fisher, author of Nutcracker Nation. Thank you, Jennifer, out in California. Thanks for joining us.
Happy Nutcracker season.
We'll go out with a pine forest in winter. Happy Nutcracker season indeed. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.